Today on the podcast, a mantelpiece moment that took me to the movies, a novel that takes us to a fantasy land, and of course, the weekly reveal to what magical book I have pulled down from my to-be-read shelf. All of that and more this week on A Novel Review. Hello and welcome to the literature podcast, A Novel Review. My name is Seamus, your host, and together we will discuss, dissect, and explore the wonderful world of literature. And the wonderful world of literature is a vast and dense jungle. So let's start making our way through, one book at a time. Hey guys, welcome back. Another day, another episode, same host, and coming at you today from a bit of a wet Sunday morning here in London, which might not be that great for going outside, but is perfect for reading books and for doing a book podcast. So let's crack on. But I guess before I crack on, I always take a moment to reflect on any mantelpiece moments, something to highlight from the week past, and this past week, I went and saw the film Dune 2, which is, of course, based on the Frank Herbert book Dune, and it's the second half of the first book. So many things I could say about it. So many words, thoughts, ideas, sentences, lines come to mind. But I guess, if I could sum it up, two words, visual feast. I think, I love reading sci-fi. I really do enjoy reading sci-fi, and I think it's fantastic when it's written well, as all things are, but there is something special about seeing it executed just perfectly on the big screen. I mean, just seeing sci-fi on the big screen done really, really well it's just a treat for the eyes, for the senses, for everything. It was absolutely fantastic. I'm a big fan of the director, Denis Villeneuve, and I absolutely love the first one. I love his other works as well, and he's really showing himself as a sci-fi expert, to be honest, but absolutely loved it. Visual feast. I'd recommend everyone going to see it. My only advice is try to see it on the biggest screen possible, because bloody fantastic. Bit of housekeeping. If you would like to like and subscribe, that would be great, but please do not feel obliged. We're here to have a good time. So yeah. It's free. Enjoy it. Thanks. The mind is its own place, and itself can make heaven of hell and hell of heaven. We start today with a quote from Milton's Paradise Lost, which is a quote about perception and where you are and how you yourself have the ability to influence and change the world you perceive and therefore the world you live in. It's something to really consider when reading this book that I'm about to discuss and listening to these episodes concerning the first three in the series. I'm going to be doing the first three books in the series. It's done in chronicles, so there's the first three books which makes up the first chronicle, then there's the second three books which makes up the second chronicle, and then I believe there's four books in the third chronicle. I'm just doing the first three this year because they're big books and, you know, I don't want to do all of them all at once. So anyways, let's get on with it. Head first into this fantasy novel by Stephen Donaldson, Lord Foulsbane, The Chronicles of Thomas Covenant, The Unbeliever. I came across this series when a friend stayed with me, and as a thank you, he actually bought me the second Chronicles of the book series, which we did not realize at the time that it was the second, and therefore only realized later. And so therefore I went on this hunt to sort of find the first three books. I was successful in finding book two and three secondhand, but yeah, had to buy the first book brand new, which we don't hate at all because let's support the authors. Managed to find them, so managed to start reading them. So yeah, as I said, this year I'm going to be reviewing and reading and reading and reviewing the first trilogy of the books. Maybe next year the second trilogy. I don't know. We'll see how we go. Third trilogy, I've done a bit of reading about, and apparently it isn't as loved as the first two, and the first two, well, apparently the end of the second trilogy comes to like a really nice succinct end that you don't actually need the third series, but the author obviously had plans for a third series, so yeah, we might get there one day. I'm in no rush, we'll see. So let's talk about this first book, Lord Foulsbane. It came out in 1977, which is actually the year the first Star Wars came out. So, good year for fantasy sci-fi. I don't know. Just a fun fact for you. I think before I actually talk about the book, I have to do a brief overview because the book does push the boundaries for literature and especially fantasy literature. So, yeah, let's just crack on with an overview. The story opens up in our world, just a regular place. It's a seemingly regular guy, Thomas Covenant. He's a published author. He has a wife and child, but then he discovers that he has leprosy, which costs him two fingers on a hand. His wife then leaves him, taking the child, and society as a result shuns him. Then one day, walking home, he falls, hits his head, and wakes up in a fantasy place called The Land, where he is hailed as a savior and descendant from a previous hero named Beric Halfhand. Thomas is, let's say, a bit perplexed, confused, and as a result, combined with previous experiences with people, he is quite rude, unfair, grumpy, basically a bit of a dick, and this comes out really badly in a scene I will discuss in a bit. Basically, though, when he first enters into this world, he meets the chief villain, Lord Foul, and another shifty character in Drool Rockworm. Lord Foul says that he has prophesied that he will destroy the land within 49 years and that this will happen a lot faster if Drool Rockworm isn't stopped. It's an incredibly curious moment because he is telling Thomas the plan and also telling him to deliver a message to the inhabitants of the land about what and when disaster will strike. Now, it's curious because surely an evil master genius, at least a good one, would want to keep his plan a secret, but alas, he does not. And so the plot for the story is set. Thomas is to deliver a message to try save the land. This is quite a brief overview, and it's very difficult to be succinct in a fantasy series because, I mean, they're often just so incredibly large stories. So yeah, there's so much going on, but that was a very brief overview. Now, anyone that knows or has heard of this book knows that it has a seriously defining moment, and it comes pretty early on when Thomas wakes up in the land. After Lord Foul has told him the plan and sets him off on his lofty quest, Thomas meets a girl named Lena, who, with the help of some special mod called Hurtloam, manages to fix Thomas's leprosy. Lena is convinced that Thomas is Beric Halfhand, a reincarnated version of this former hero, and so praises Thomas as a result of this. Thomas has now regained a sense of feeling in his body in general thanks to the Hurtloam, and what happens next is he rapes Lena. Now I'm going to pause for a moment because it's a difficult scene, especially because Lena is so young, so she's incredibly sweet, she's kind, but this scene is incredibly divisive, and I don't mean in a bad way that, some people don't view it as rape or anything surrounding the definitions of rape or anything like that. No, everyone agrees that he rapes her. It's more sort of divisive in the fact that people, and I read reviews of this, some people said they literally threw the book against a wall, some people stopped reading instantly, and one person said that this book would be unable to be published in this current day and age. That review was in 2023, so last year. I think that I can only really discuss this and debate this in this way because it is a fantasy story, so it is kind of a philosophical thought experiment. So yeah, let's get this off the bat early. Rape is incredibly wrong. It's disgusting. It's foul. A debasement of humanity. Rape is rape, and it always will be. And it's always the perpetrator's fault. None of this. Oh, maybe the person deserved it or played up to it, etc. No. Nothing like that. But I do think there are a few things you could and should consider before you launch a book at a wall in this particular instance. This is a man that had an incredibly good life. Who's a published writer. He had a wife and child. He then got devastatingly sick with leprosy, started along a sort of steady decline of loss of feeling, lost his wife, lost his child, considers himself a leper. He calls himself outcast, unclean, leper, outcast, unclean, which are three words he sort of routinely repeats to himself. Society shuns him to the point that no one wants to be near him, so no one wants to speak to him, no one wants to even acknowledge his existence. And then one day he hits his head, wakes up in a fantasy land, and one of the first things that happens is he's hailed as a hero, given a special treatment that heals him of his pain and restores his senses that has been killed by this devastating sickness. And I guess these are some pretty wild circumstances, especially when that you consider the fact that at this stage in the story, we don't even know if this is real. You know, it could all just be a dream, all his subconscious. He could be dead for all we know because he has fallen and hit his head. I think what I'm trying to say is this is a terrible person committing a terrible act, but that doesn't mean that I'm going to stop reading the story because I don't know where the rest of the story is. It's a really interesting conversation, I think, because there are a lot of moral gray areas here, you know, like murder is wrong always. We always think murder is wrong unless we train you up and train you as a soldier and send you off to kill people, in which case we think it's all right. So there's kind of a gray area between what do we consider murder. And so I guess I like this idea of exploring it because it is an interesting conversation. And rape is often about power, you know, seizing power over someone less helpless, which is an interesting discussion, I think, for someone like this character of Thomas. And yeah, I don't know where the story's going and I don't know what's going to happen. But I mean, when we first met Jaime Lannister, for instance, in A Song of Ice and Fire, the first book of Game of Thrones, he's having sex with his sister. And then because Bran saw it, he pushes Bran out the window in order to buy his silence with his death. So he's committing incest and attempted murder on a child, which quite easily could have been murder on a child. Now, I didn't see anyone throwing the book at the wall for that case. There's tons of other instances, you know, when he's playing Captain Jack Sparrow in the first book, he says he's going to rape, pillage and plunder his Weasley back black guts out. And so he literally said he's going to rape people, but, you know, tons of kids still watch that. And so I guess what I'm just trying to get to is that Jaime Lannister in the books, at least in the TV show, because we haven't got all the books yet, goes on to have one of the best redemptive arcs. And I'm not trying to say that Thomas can be redeemed. And I think that it's an incredibly individual thing whether you think he can be redeemed. I personally don't think you can come back from rape. Once you've raped someone, you've raped someone. And so I don't think you can come back. But I still think there can be shades of redemption somewhere along the way. You know, I think it is fair to say that someone who commits a petty crime or something like that, stealing, they could be redeemed, whereas murderers and rapists perhaps can't be redeemed. So then there is sort of a grey area here where you can be redeemed up until a point, and sort of where is that line? And I guess it's an interesting idea to explore this, and I guess it's sort of the perfect opportunity. It's a fantasy novel, and like I said, it's essentially a thought experiment played out. You know, in philosophy, we always have thought experiments to see how things would be perceived, and it's a perfect opportunity to explore this idea of redemption and how it could be perceived and can it actually be achieved. You know, Stephen wrote this when discussing the motivation behind Thomas as a character. He wrote, "I had conceived the ambition to write a fantasy novel about a real character who rejected the fantasy experience, no doubt partly in an attempt to answer my own questions about why fantasy matters. And it occurred to me one day that if I wanted my character to have any true substance, he would have to be someone with a very personal reason to prefer fantasy, a leper in this case, someone for whom integrity is more important than convenience or easy gratification. And of course, integrity is a journey. We don't simply have it. First, we have to discover it, then we have to earn it." He wanted to write a real character, a very interesting choice of words. But just getting back now to the book and to this scene in particular, but this might be an odd thing to say, but it is an interesting scene because there is no governing power. There is no police force. There's no one to actually bring justice to Thomas. So instead, the justice is one of a moral one. I'm not saying that there has been any justice dealt to him yet, of course, but I am saying the guilt and the shame for Thomas and the anger of everyone else becomes more philosophical exploration, which I'm sure it does sort of have this growing effect because I have looked ahead and I have seen that it does influence the stories later on in the series. But the moral question of duty then arises because after the rape, Thomas meets with Lena's family and Lena's mother agrees to travel with Thomas to the capital. Essentially, I'm sort of breaking it down in very, very simple terms so I don't overload you with the jargonistic names of fantasy stories. But she decides to take him to the capital. So they set off on this little, you know, lofty quest. And along the way, along the journey, some people catch up and basically tell her that Thomas has raped her daughter. What happens is this really curious question is that we see Lena's mother, Etarian. She truly believes that Thomas is sort of the hero, this returned Christ of sorts, and that she has to decide what to do with this shocking news. Deal revenge and satisfy her anger, or recognize that maybe keeping Thomas alive and delivering him to this more important ideal that's looming over them. And so she has to sort of make this self-sacrifice, and it's sort of also culminated in the fact that the land is hell-bent on peace. The fantasy land is hell-bent on peace, and they all sort of subscribe to this idea that we don't kill if we don't have to, and no one should be murdering people. And it's this really sort of nice ideal, but then of course, how do you punish people that deserve to be punished? It's sort of this paradox of tolerance, and it becomes this really curious question. And like I said, it's this moral exploration, philosophical exploration of the morally gray areas. You know, if we've been sworn to peace, how do we deal out justice to people like rapists? I found it quite a poignant moment because I reckon I know how I would have reacted in that moment if I'd heard that my daughter had been raped and you know, I was now helping that person sort of succeed in this quest. You know, it made me think about my own levels of self-sacrifice and what I guess I stand for. And I mean, it's sort of one of those wonderful questions that fantasy gets to explore because it doesn't hurt anyone in the real world. That being said, yeah, I just want to reiterate, it is a terrible, terrible thing, right? Because it's disgusting. But I know I have read reviews and sort of delved into the future of what this series holds. And Thomas apparently does spend a lot of the next few books with intense guilt and despair. And that's why fantasy is so set up to explore these ideas, because they're normally these big journeys taking over multiple books. And what needs to happen is, if you are going to come back from something like rape or one of these things where you need a long redemptive arc, it needs to be explored over many books, over a long time period. It's not just like quick wins like that. Like, it needs to be small incremental steps to build you back up if you can be built back up. And, you know, I guess for me personally, I don't think he can be built back up. I think in my eyes, he's always going to be this terrible person that raped a girl. And I guess that's sort of what I'm really interested to read about is, can he win back any affection for me? It's kind of frightening because on so many levels, I think, no, I don't want him to, and I don't want to be pushed to a level where I'm questioning this kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, this is why we love fantasy, because it just gets to ask these big questions and explore these things over multiple books. So, I mean, we're going to see what happens. I think it's also worth noting that a lot of people come to fantasy expecting to follow the hero. And in this case, Thomas is not the hero. He's actually just the protagonist of the story. And it's really important to note that they are not the same thing. This section with Etarian is also one of my favorites because it's this lovely period that the majority of fantasy novels have where they're sort of walking through the world. And there's these great long passages where we see the world develop page by page. Some people love this period. Some people hate it because usually it's just walking and world building. But yeah, it's one of my favorites of any fantasy novel because I want to know the world. I want to know that the writer has sold me the book effectively and that I feel like I'm in this world. You know, you are God as the writer. You created it. Show me that you created it. Show me that you have control of this world that you've created and that this world doesn't control you and that you actually have taken care to plan. And yeah, just show me that I can visualize this world and, you know, show me that you have visualized this world. Show me that you can tell me and communicate this world. So it's a really rich opportunity. And I think it's one of the more important opportunities that fantasy novels need to seize because, yeah, it really highlights to the reader if you have control of this world that you're writing about. It's a great period with this, you know, moments of incredibly vivid descriptions like this one. So I've got a quote for you and it reads, "Then the full clouts of the storm hit them. The winds scourged the rain southward as if the sky were lashing at them, at every defenseless living thing. Soon the hillsides were drenched with ferocity. The wind rent at the trees, tore, battered the grass. It struck daylight from the hills, buried the earth in preternatural night. Etarian and Covenant were soaked, gasping through the torrent." I mean, there's just something about being in a storm in a fantasy novel that is just so fun. And I don't know, seeing the storm drag the night across the sky, it's always just yeah, so incredibly vivid for me at least. So I'm not going to sit here and say, you know, it is a perfect novel. Some of the writing does get quite stuck in your mouth, but I mean, hey, you can look at the negatives, you can look at the positives. I think in this instance, if you do want to keep reading the series, you have to kind of look to the positives because, like I've, you know, discussed quite extensively, there is a bloody huge negative at the start of this book that, yeah, has ruined it for people and made people switch off and stop reading. One of the areas I think the story does really lack is the name of the characters. Now, you know, I know, of course, not every story is going to have the care and finesse of a Tolkien, where the names feel like they've been sort of carved out of marble with these rich histories guided by language. But I do think names like Lord Fowl and Drool Rockworm and Saltheart Foam Follower are a bit funny in a sense. But I mean, hey, it was the 70s, so I don't know. Let's try and have a little fun with it. Like, yeah, I kind of love those kind of justifications. Like, it was the 70s, don't worry about it, as if that's some kind of like justification for how things are. Yeah. I won't talk any more about the storyline sort of in general, but I will say the story did evolve nicely. The one thing that sort of did confuse me the whole time is Lord Fowl telling his plan ahead of time, which always seemed like a bit silly, but then it sort of does come back around and makes a lot of sense. And suddenly Lord Fowl goes from, at least for me, goes from being this kind of kooky villain to a master tactician. That's all I'll say about that, but it was definitely a lovely surprise to see this because it does add this sort of depth to the story, and I think it is quite needed. It would have been a huge shame if, like, this book had been exploring all these dark, dark philosophical questions only to turn around and kind of mess up the darkness of the story itself. But it doesn't, and yeah, I just won't mention any more about that. This book does feel like just quite a conventional fantasy story, which for me was fine. In fact, it was actually quite nice. It was very much like an adventure quest, and I think that's something I really enjoyed was this story is actually very well contained in that it begins and ends quite tightly. So if this story isn't for you, you could stop and not feel a resounding sense of loss at the end. You wouldn't feel necessarily compelled to keep reading the story just because it's a series. If it isn't your cup of tea, obviously at the end of the first book, Thomas hasn't really been dealt any kind of retribution for his horrific act. But yeah, if you read the first one and decided it wasn't for you, you could stop. But I, however, quite enjoyed it. So I will be reading book two. So stay tuned for that. So time for a rating. This is a bit difficult because I know a lot of people don't like or read fantasy. So I'm going to say this rating is more based on if you like fantasy, and I'm going to rate it a 3.7 out of 5. You know, it's a solid story. It had some nice writing, strong foundation. And yeah, I can't wait for book two and to see where the story goes. So what am I reading this week? This week, it would be rude not to announce that I have started reading book two, Thomas Covenant, The Unbeliever, The Ill-Earth War. It's, you know, a very nice big book, which, you know, I love sinking my teeth into big books. So yeah, I guess we know that Thomas is back in the land and we're off on another adventure. And I mean, I'm, what am I, 262 pages in? Smashing it a bit too quickly. Let's just say this book is miles ahead of the first one. This is so much better. Like, if you got to the end of the first one and were kind of torn whether you wanted to continue or not, I would say definitely continue. If you get to the end of the first book and think, no, I definitely don't want to continue, that's fine, stop. But if you got to the end and were like, oh, I'm kind of unsure, definitely keep reading then, because this book is miles ahead of the other one. There are some fantastic passages in here, some fantastic conversations going on. It's so rich, it's so vibrant, it's so interesting. Yeah, I'm enjoying it. Now, before I close out the show, if you have listened this far, please consider hitting those 5 stars. I would really appreciate it. Also, feel free to head along to the website and support the pod. And of course, as always, thank you for your attention. So I think it's time to end this episode, and today to take us away, I think some Victor Hugo, and he writes, "Music expresses that which cannot be put into words, and that which cannot remain silent.